Brought to you by Leave the Ring Network. All boxing, no filter.
Oh! That's another knockdown.
He's not getting up, Jim.
He get up.
He's not getting up, Jim. He's not getting up.
No, he's been knocked out.
It's over. Mamma mia, he's done it. Anthony Joshua defeats Vladimir Klitschko. AJ does it in style.
Beaten down, hopeless, without an answer, and Lomachenko has made Rigondeaux quit.
It's Fisgionados with Evan Rutkowski.
He's a good boy, you know.
Hello, fight fans. It is Thursday, August 1st, and this is the Fisgionados podcast on the Leave It in the Ring radio network. I'm your host, Evan Rutkowski, former HBO sports marketing executive, giving you my take on what's happening in the sport of boxing on your screen and behind the scenes. Email me at fistinatos@yahoo.com. Follow me on Twitter at fistinatospod. We are brought to you by Ring Magazine and ringtv.com. Couple of news and notes before we start. This episode is going to be a fun one. I had a deep dive written out, researched and everything on Top Rank's year so far. I'm going to put that next episode 2 weeks from now and just talk about stuff that happened in the sport of boxing over the last 2 weeks. On a personal note, I am now a father for the second time. So even putting that deep dive up actually probably helps me out a lot just in terms of living my normal life. Or whatever that is now that I have a second kid. So that's been an awesome experience. Obviously, shout out to my wife and my second daughter. I was a guest on Chris Mannix's podcast. I encourage everyone to check that out. We did talk about, I'm going to touch on a lot of the same issues. Not a lot. I'm going to touch on some of the same issues that we talked about on that and probably either go over some different aspects to them if I dive too deep into them. I'm going to try my best not to cover the same stuff though for this, but I just think given everything that's happened, especially in the last 2 weeks, especially this past weekend, I know I'm coming out on Thursday, but this past weekend, the 27th, two really significant, you know, events, and one of which I did not think would be significant at all on Showtime, but great job on Tank Davis for doing what he did. So let's jump right into it. In the review section, I mean, we're going back to Friday, July 19th, the Teofimo Lopez, and obviously the tragedy with Maxime Dadashov. This is the interesting about this. I don't talk about fights that I don't watch. And I actually didn't watch this fight card. This was going to be something, it streamed on Friday. Teofimo Lopez won by, sounded like somewhat of a relatively boring unanimous decision over Masayoshi Nakatami. And, you know, he obviously moves on and he's going to fight Richard Comey, which is the most significant thing for him. There is the Maxime Dadashov tragedy that happened. A lot of people have had really well thought out commentary on this. Obviously, I'll just say it is a tragedy. I didn't actually watch it. I was planning on watching it because the next day was going to have the UK fights and then the Pacquiao-Thurman pay-per-view. I was planning on watching it on Sunday and just kind of not going to be on social media until the Thurman fight came on. And I had caught up on everything, you know, except this. I figured I might see. I try not to know any results before I actually watch the fights happen. That wasn't the case here. You know, you sort of follow the story. Look, absolute tragedy. I'm not going to talk about it too much because I didn't watch it. Let's move on to Saturday, July 20th. We'll start with the UK fights. DAZN brought us Dillian White with a unanimous decision over Oscar Rivas. Derek Chisora with a KO2 over Artur Spilka. And David Price with a unanimous decision win over Dave Allen on the two undercards. The Price win was really boring. And unfortunately, kind of makes him relevant as an opponent for another big heavyweight this fall, especially a British one, if they're going to do the fight in the UK. Chisora looked great. I think we're at the point with Spielka where I certainly don't need to see him on TV much longer, you know, both for my entertainment and his health. And, you know, especially with what happens here on the PED issue that we're about to get to in a second. Chisora, look, this, you know, just beating anybody and staying relevant, coming back, he might find himself in a very good position this fall as an opponent where he can get paid pretty well. So on that note, let's go to the main event. I thought White looked really good in the fight. I thought he probably won by a wider margin than most of what the judges had. The big issue here is that is the drug test. Tom Hauser wrote a great article about this. You know, Mike Coppinger wrote a follow-up piece, you know, which included some of the glove stuff, and maybe someone else wrote about the gloves too that I'm not aware of, but that was kind of the first time I had read it. The gloves honestly might even, you know, be more of an egregious violation than the drug test here. There's the aftermath of all of it with Riva's team essentially not getting notified of the positive drug test. Rather than give all the details for what happened and call this whole thing a train wreck, which it basically is, let's talk about what we can do to fix the issue, maybe. And this will be one of the topics I sort of dive a little bit deeper into. And look, a lot of people, you know, including Hauser, have called for networks to be responsible for this kind of drug testing. Like, this might be its own extended deep dive for me one day on this podcast. I think the very short answer here is the worst case scenario for networks. I think I've said this before. It's a tragedy. It's something like what happened, you know, basically this weekend in two separate incidents where there's a real tragedy in the ring. And then there's a failed drug test for the, you know, opponent that, you know, that involved in the tragedy that obviously didn't happen. There were two separate incidents. That's the worst case scenario. but I do think when you know, networks requiring a third party to drug test all of their fights is a step in the right direction. But I also think, like, some people act like that's, you know, not that it's going to solve everything, but that's like an easy fix that should just, you know, be great. And I think it also must be noted that it does bring up its own set of issues. And if you kind of want a preview of those issues, go look at the UFC model. Like, they have Jeff Nowitzki as an in-house executive who was formerly at USADA, who's responsible for their drug testing. And I think, like, there's no doubt it's added credibility to what they're doing. There are some very noteworthy issues. I mean, first of all, like, you know, the false positive issue. Like, if you look at who... And I am not the person to go through this, but there are many journalists who have talked to lawyers who have gone through false positives for fighters in the UFC. I mean, basically, it's going to cost you a tremendous amount of money and time to defend yourself, to prove that you're innocent. You know, and obviously, these are careers where time is extremely important. So, look, and doesn't mean we shouldn't be doing it, doing drug testing, just something to be noted. I also think, like, maybe more importantly, on an organizational level, you have to be careful when someone within your organization is responsible for all this, because especially when a big fighter in a big money fight gets popped, like, what's the reaction going to be? Is his job going to be to keep the circus going and use that credibility that he's bringing to the organization to just kind of keep the train moving? Or does he truly have independence on the issue, even though he may report in a business corporate reporting structure to someone who really cares more about keeping the circus moving and keeping the fights going than anything else? I'm not accusing of anybody here, let's just be clear, but, like, that is something where when it's within the organization, it starts to get interesting. And the UFC uses USADA testing. All you need to do is read some of the Hauser articles about USADA in boxing, and you can just, I'll leave it at that. You'll start asking some questions. I also do want to point out the parallels here, especially with the punitive damages to the actual political war on drugs that happened in the United States in the 1980s. Like, if you're interested in diving further into this, you know, I am not the person to read on this. I've not written at all on it, and I've barely talked about it on the podcast. I'm a semi-interested party who likes intelligent discussion over it. Luke Thomas is an MMA journalist who's done some really interesting interviews with actual scientists who have talked about it way more extensively. I will leave it at that. All I would say is I would question, you know, question everything when it comes here, when it comes to this subject. What I will talk about is a little bit more of what networks can do. One thing that is probably a better step in the right direction than network simply drug testing, which, you know, might in practice on a boxing level actually just kind of look like what the WBC is doing right now or what state athletic commissions do right now. You know, networks could have one, you know, and I think this is especially true with networks that just have one promotional or content entity in the PBC, you know, with what you'd call the PBC. If they just have one of those things as their main content provider, they would actually work with that promoter or content entity and say, hey, if you're going to fight on ESPN or if you're going to fight on Fox, you know, under the Top Rank or PBC banner, then you need to be in VADA 365 testing for these fights to happen, which I think is starting to get to the point where we have, and this is not a real, like, this is not a totally comprehensive solution, but I think you're actually starting to get to the core of the problem here. And I think, like, when you look at the Dillian White case, like, what a lot of people are missing here is that there was drug testing for this. There was VADA drug testing for this. If you just read the headline is basically going to tell you guy tested positive and then stepped into the ring without letting other guy know about it. And look, that is obviously egregious. But what the headline doesn't say is that per the commission, all the rules were followed. VADA drug tested, they did not detect anything. The test, what was detected was incredibly trace amounts, which maybe that's a false positive. Maybe that's a tainted supplement. Maybe that's someone cycling off of what, you know, what they were doing beforehand and they knew the schedule. Stephen Breadman Edwards has talked about that at length. I feel like he is another great person to, you know, if you want to hear someone intelligent talk about what fighters might do, that he's great on that. But I think it just brings up, you know, I've repeated the, you know, there's a famous line about this that I repeat. I didn't come up with it. But when you're the drug testing for an event, it is an IQ test when you're doing it on an event by event basis. So asking networks to pay for drug testing for their events when there is already drug testing for the events they broadcast in place, I mean, it's a lot of, you know, look, it's like kind of both ridiculous on one hand, and it's kind of another step in the right direction on the other hand. But when now you've got a couple of different parties trying to do the same thing, but no one really doing it that well, you know, and I think also you go back and look at it and say, like, I guess my overall point is this isn't as easy as just saying, hey, we're paying $50 million in license fees. Let's add another million or two, or you need to take that million or two out of the $50 million we're paying you and make sure there's drug testing. I think this is something where there needs to be commitment from the network and the promoter or the content entity, in the case of the PBC. And I think the costs would be a lot higher than what most people are estimating right now. If you just, you know, here's the thing. It's like there would be an economy of scale that doesn't make the cost ridiculous. Like, let's just say in Fox case, you're going to say every PBC fighter who's under the PBC banner, and especially the ones that we know are going to fight on Fox, they're just automatically in 365 VADA testing. You know, that does provide some economy of scale, but what we're really talking about here is like a league structure. And I think the main difference between boxing and any other league, and even the UFC too on this, is that, like, if there's a major NFL quarterback who fails a drug test, or there's a UFC, even a UFC main event fighter Like, the Bears versus the Lions game, that still happens on the date that it was scheduled for. UFC 238 or 242 or whatever they're on right now, that still happens. Like, even if the main event fails, like, they've kind of built their brand not on it being major fighter versus, you know, major fighter in a pay-per-view fight. It's just UFC in a number, and if the main event falls out, they've made the card deep enough that the hardcore fans will still buy it. That's changing, obviously, to a certain extent. We've talked about this on this podcast, but the event still happens, is my point. It's a much more difficult conversation in boxing, especially, you know, now the sport is not on pay cable platforms. It's really easy to reschedule stuff on Showtime and HBO on Saturday nights. Boxing is pretty much one of the only things they do in terms of original programming. That's not the case on Fox. It's not the case on ESPN, certainly. You know, all those places. Like, there's issues that come up with this. Like, what if the opponent is from another promoter that doesn't have VADA 365? You could probably just say, hey, look, drug testing starts the second they agree to the fight. You know, hopefully that makes it fair for everyone. I mean, bigger picture, I think this idea is probably several steps in the right direction, but, you know, you still have to go through a lot of other stuff, like how punishment's given. Like, we don't have a great system right now where the punishment actually fits the crime. We don't even know a lot about what the punishment should be for what crime is committed in certain cases, like basically what drugs really help, what drugs don't really help. Like, you know, there's just not a lot of knowledge about that and where you get advantages. But I mean, even looking at more at the timing, like a 2-year ban, if you're in a smaller weight class and your career is going to be likely over by the time you're, you know, 30 or 31 versus, you know, a 2-year ban there versus and also paydays are smaller. So you got to take as many of those 6-figure paydays as possible. 2-year ban there looks a lot different than a 2-year ban if you're a heavyweight, where you can probably fight until your late 30s. And, you know, there's, in a glamour division, there's paydays to be had. And you know, if you can work your way back into the conversation, you can get them. And 2-year ban is one thing. I know the criticism when the ban gets down to like 6 months is that it doesn't really affect fighters because they take 6 months in between fights anyways. But again, I think, you know, the bigger issue here is you need punishments that fit the crimes, which is currently something we don't really have. I think a system like this where a promoter works with the network to do it, look, cost would still be pretty big. It starts to be a respectable system, though, in terms of you can probably go out there and say somewhere in an incredibly respectable amount of fighters are not cheating the system. And you can legitimately say that. You know, I'd also want to ask, how much do consumers really care about this? Another great question for a great time. But let's just move on with all this. Also on Saturday, July 20th, in on Fox pay-per-view, we have Manny Pacquiao beating Keith Thurman by majority decision in a fantastic fight to win the WBA, the WBA title at welterweight. And, you know, not that Pacquiao's legacy needed much more, but adds another amazing chapter to it. On the undercard, your Dennis Ugas won by wide unanimous decision over Omar Figueroa, hopefully ending the notion that Figueroa can be matched up against elite welterweights. Sergey Lipinets wins by KO2 versus late replacement Jair Inson at welterweight. And Luis Neri wins by KO9 against Juan Carlos Payano at bantamweight. Caleb Plant wins by KO3 against Mike Lee to defend his super middleweight title on the non-pay-per-view undercard. And Efe Ajagba beats Ali Demizarian by unanimous decision, also on the non-pay-per-view undercard on Fox. That Fox portion averages 923,000 viewers. Let's be clear, that's not a great number at all, and it probably extrapolates to way less than what the pay-per-views ended up being, if you're using a model at all, at least based on what the UFC has done in the past. The UFC model, and I say this because UFC would do all, for boxing fans who aren't aware, UFC would do, they do a prelim card, and then they do the actual pay-per-view. So the prelim card would be on you know, previously ESPN or Fox Sports 1, and then the pay-per-view comes on after that. I'm not sure that model, I'm not sure fully translates to boxing. I don't want to abandon it completely as a concept, though, but I think it would need to be reworked, especially when there are four cards, you know, boxing, you know, UFC, there's five cards in a fight, but they're three-round fights, you know, 5 minutes per round. Boxing, I mean, if you have like four 10-minute rounds, it's just a longer card in general. And the amount of time that the networks do in between fights on pay-per-views, especially when there's quick knockouts, is just kind of crazy. And I think that's one of the main reasons I don't think this kind of system works that well. Like, I think in the end of the day, probably would have just rather seen Caleb Plant fight, you know, on the pay-per-view undercard, and had that be that, not on the main TV portion. Let's go to pay-per-view numbers. Mike Coppinger was the first to report the numbers. He came in as about 500K as the number. This happened about a week ago. So it's Thursday of the week after the fight happened, which, as a note, I mean, that usually means the number is lower than expected when we don't hear something Monday or Tuesday. My whole last episode deep dive was devoted to this, and I talked a little bit about it with Mannix. But I'll talk about hopefully some different stuff here. Like, first of all, I wasn't shocked to see some delay in the numbers coming out for a couple of reasons. I mean, the metrics that I heard were all over the place. These are not reported numbers. These are stuff you hear from sort of first and secondhand sources. Some of the cable satellite companies had good numbers and some did not at all. There was no general consensus from what I was hearing, but like, if I had to give a number on my end, most of the metrics and the talk would be that we would be in the 475 to 500 range. That number comes from sort of a lot of art and less science than you'd think. On the digital side of things, the platforms that weren't Fox, they were modeling, not extrapolating but modeling below 300,000 pay-per-view buys in total. In some cases, well below that. And that's, just to be clear, that's not info from Fox's digital platform, which may account for the low number. But like, this is a model that understands that Fox is also doing, you know, the digital stuff. And I don't know how well they did, but, you know, I would think Fox digital platform did pretty well. But look, I'm just saying, that's not a great sign at all for it. And a side note here. You know, digital pay-per-view, basically, people are buying pay-per-views on digital more and more with every fight. I talked about this a little bit last week. Like, the cable numbers are going down. The satellite numbers are going down. Digital is increasing every fight. Like, obviously, you want to see more than it model out to that. Another important thing here, these buys are clearly more important than buys from the cable systems. And people actually gave Arum a ton of crap for saying that the Crawford fight did really well on digitally. And I don't normally talk about that fight. Obviously, if you're a longtime listener, I consult on that. Don't really talk about it. Because that, what I will say, I will verify he was being truthful on that element of it. And let's be clear, in terms of how much a digital buy is worth to a promoter, it can be worth at least 1.5 times as much. And in some cases, almost twice as much as a pay-per-view bought through a cable system. It also could be worth, you know, a little bit less than that. But there's probably no scenario where it's not at least 1.25 times as much. It's not, I mean, it's a significant thing. I mean, in a lot of cases, it can literally, when you factor in all the factors, it can almost be worth twice as much in some cases as a pay-per-view. At least financially worth to you as a promoter, what a pay-per-view, you know, bought through the traditional system is. So when you look at the other sort of digital imprint, though, like Fox's digital numbers in terms of social interaction and digital content consumption, they were huge leading up to the fight. And the way you market the fight can have a major effect on the buy rate. So, you know, like maybe the digital buy was really high on Fox, and that, you know, counteracted the digital buy rates on other things. Other numbers I heard, first or second hand, you know, some places 350 to 400. Some places modeling out to 425. Some places modeled out to 600. Almost all of them didn't take into account what I described as this like dynamic marketplace last episode that's been created in this universe, where it used to be, and Maddox and I talked about this, I won't spend long on it, it used to be you just plugged everything into a formula. One of the, you know, you get this number, especially from DirecTV. And by the way, the DirecTV number, from what I heard, it was much higher than it normally would have been. They apparently came through at the last minute with a strong marketing effort and got a pretty decent number. And so in some instances, it modeled out to higher than that. I guess the bottom line is 500, 475, 450, maybe even 525, I doubt it. 400, we don't really know, and it's going to take a while to, and even beyond that, we don't really know that, you know, let's just use 500,000 pay-per-view buys as a number. It's a good overall number, especially in the, you know, what level of star Pacquiao is right now in his career. You know, it basically seemed like the big Fox pay-per-view bazooka worked out well for Fox, especially that they, I mean, Fox is basically taking a fee straight off the top. They don't have to account, take into account expenses. And, you know, let's take a look at this for a second. I mean, based on the reported salaries for the fight, I'm not sure it's going to make money for the PBC. There are too many unknowns. Like I said last time, the notion of the distribution, it's how it's spreading everything really thin, and you're giving up all the cable system marketing. You know, you're gaining in buys with other areas, and you're getting probably a bigger cut of each buy, especially on the digital side. You know, 500,000 buys in this world might be worth 600,000 buys in the old pay-per-view system. Like, you know, but you can't do the old math and know how it works. I mean, the old math is basically you take $75, where half the revenue goes to cable systems, so there's 500,000 buys, and you're basically getting $16, $17 million-ish for this PBC event going to the PBC. Also noteworthy, I bought the fight from Spectrum in LA. I only paid $64.99 for it, which I was very happy for. I was actually planning on streaming it just for the experience, but when I saw the price in HD on Spectrum, I just bought it there. You know, remember, LA is a huge market where somewhere between 15, 18, maybe even 20% of the total buys in the country, and a lot of, you know, Spectrum is a large part of that. It could be that, you know, less revenue for the entire show if that's where a lot of people bought it. The reported salaries to the Nevada Athletic Commission, Pacquiao made $10 million, Thurman 2.5. I mean, supposedly Pacquiao was taking home maybe his $20 million that he normally gets in his commercial heyday, maybe a little bit less than that. Thurman supposedly got $8 million. None of this counts undercard fighters or anything like that. The gate for the fight was $6 million. I mean, I don't know specifically how that got chopped up in this instance. You know, but let's just say old pay-per-view universe, you'd be looking at total revenues for the fight that aren't even close to just the rumored guaranteed salaries for the main event fighters. And like I said, I don't think we're in that universe anymore. Like I just said, I think there's scenarios where, you know, it models out a little bit differently, and I can see the revenue for the fight, you know, promotion coming in close to paying for the main event salaries. I mean, maybe you also factor in that 15% of both Pac and Thurman's salaries are going to PBC. There's no way to really confirm that. But more likely, like, PBC is probably doing better than in the traditional model. Fox is definitely doing great. But I think 500,000 buys, even in this model where they're doing better, I don't think it's covering costs. I mean, I'd say it definitely doesn't cover the reported, like the quote unquote rumored guarantees. It definitely does cover the salaries they reported to the Nevada Athletic Commission. you know, but I'm guessing what Ellen Reed probably covered some of the red ink here. I mean, it could be as little as a couple of million, maybe 2 or 3 million, could be a lot, as much as 7 or 8 million. But let's put it this way. If every single buy was $75 on, like, let's just use the digital Fox platform that probably gives Fox and PBC the best distribution cut I've heard up to date. I mean, basically, you're cutting out everybody if you're buying it on Fox. Like, PBC and Fox are taking home all the money at that way. Even at that point, I mean, you know, when you factor in Fox's cut, like, you still, for PBC, you're still not getting to $32 million in total pay-per-view revenue for them if every single one of those 500,000 buys is bought on that platform. And, I mean, that's a number that, to me, like, when you, if it's $32 million in pay-per-view revenues and you factor in gate and international, like, you know, you can make a little bit of profit on it. I mean, you know, if you factor in all the other costs and, you know, actually if PBC takes 15% cut from both PAC and Thurman, then, you know, you're probably making an okay profit on that if every single thing is like that. I know based on the DirecTV buys and some of the cable numbers that they are, you know, it's not anything close to that. But look, it's a fun exercise. I mean, I think one of the big questions in the boxing community is just how is PBC able to do this with Pacquiao? And I'll actually use this as a segue to my next subject, which is what is happening next for all these guys. I mean, I think, you know, PBC can afford this. Like, if they're making Mayweather Pacquiao 2 on pay-per-view, I think it alone would cover any losses and that PBC is taking on Pacquiao's contract, and I think it'd be great for PBC. I know that's not what core fans want to hear. Definitely not what boxing writers want to hear and what they want to cover. But look, if you think about it a certain way, like if you're PBC and you sign Pacquiao to a contract where you're eliminating his IRS bill and essentially paying him $20 million a fight, if you're doing that and you at least know, or you at least think with a lot of certainty that you can make the Mayweather fight, then this is really how it makes sense to do it. I mean, the really smart way to look at it, this deal is if you know you can make the fight, you say, look, all right, Pacquiao can do some strong buy rates on his own. And, you know, hopefully one of these things happens, like he gets his mojo back, he becomes a commercial star on his own again, we don't take a bath, or one of our guys beats him and gets the commercial rub and becomes a major star in their own right, then it's worth it. I mean, Broner was sort of the perfect like first fight for this because Pacquiao got his mojo back and he did okay on pay-per-view, you know, 425, whatever he got for that. You know, Thurman was a really good second fight for this. It's kind of like, all right, we're not throwing you Spence, but here, if you can beat Thurman then and do well commercially and the buy rates, you know, given the pay-per-view universe that we're in, actually, you know, like I said from the top, like 500,000, pretty good buy rate. I mean, we're not justifying paying Pacquiao $20 million for it, like maybe $10 million, maybe $12 million, but, you know, decent overall buy rate. And if you look at like, okay, 425 for Broner, 475, 500 for Thurman, like again, there's just no math you can come up with that justifies paying Pacquiao, but it's a justifiable risk if you know you can make the Mayweather fight. You know, I talked about this a little bit with Mannix. I don't want to get too much into it, but if PBC knew from the beginning that they were building back towards Mayweather Pacquiao 2, then they're going to do really well from Pacquiao's overall deal. Even if the first, you know, even if you're like sitting here trying to come up with math for the first two fights to make money, I mean, the analogy I'll make here is again an NBA move, which just seems to work well for analogies in boxing when you're talking about the business side. Like this Pacquiao Thurman pay per view, let's just say it does 500,000 buys, whatever that number ends up being, like it's like an NBA trade where you just clear cap space. Like Brooklyn did this recently, the Knicks did it towards the, you know, they kind of did. Like there are plenty of other examples of this. Like, maybe there are pathways to the first two fights only being minor money losers. But Pacquiao doing the numbers he did against real opponents and getting wins now means he's a legitimate Mayweather opponent. You can definitely sell that fight. And if you can sell that fight, and if you can get, like, let's just say, in that 3 million pay-per-view buy rate, which I totally think you can do. I mean, maybe, you know, maybe you're only doing half and it's 2.3 or 2.4 million or what, you know, something like that. I think you can do better than that. I think, like, if you can hit that 3 million mark, everybody's making up so much money. It's the NBA equivalent. Like, you know, Brooklyn gave up future assets in a trade where they created cap space. Well, they signed Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving, so it worked out great. So, you know, if they didn't, then it kind of looks stupid and you lose money. And, you know, so it, are these pay-per-views genius moves where you're building to this thing where you are going to make a ton of money? Yeah, maybe they are. I mean, I'm not even mad at seeing Mayweather Pacquiao 2 again. I think, you know, it's been so long since Floyd's been in a legit fight. I think it's actually probably a good fight. I mean, you know, Floyd clearly won the first time. Even in these circumstances, it's hard not to favor him the second time, but I think it's really a coin flip fight just because he's been so inactive and Pacquiao's looked so great. There's still scenarios, if this doesn't happen next, there's still scenarios where it might not be a bad move. Like, you know, maybe you lose $5 or $10 million, but Errol Spence becomes a star out of it. You get Fox to sort of reset the market with the cable companies that helps you out in the long term. And look, maybe just White Allen Reed is absorbing these losses, which could very well be the case, and the whole thing was worth it. I mean, if Al is absorbing the loss and PBC is absorbing it, like, it's really a tough one. But I guess for consumers, if you're not absorbing the loss, so at least for a one-off pay-per-view, who cares? I mean, I think where it matters to consumers is if PBC needs to recoup the losses from the Showtime and Fox contracts. And we have no evidence of that right now, but it certainly could be the case on some level. And if it is the case, and then we're getting worse fights from Showtime and Fox to fund these pay-per-views, I'm sure no one would be a fan of that. You know, again, I'm not seeing evidence of that specifically. It is worth bringing up, though. All right, on to the other fighters involved here. Keith Thurman made a really strong account of himself, and while he's not a pay-per-view star coming out of this, it will probably serve him well. It walks back all those old narratives about how dedicated he was to boxing, how his fights haven't been super exciting. You know, I think you should probably see him back on Fox in a main event against a B-level opponent, you know, and then hopefully back in the title mix somewhere. It was nice to see Ugas come back with a win. He can probably parlay that into a title shot or at least get another fight on Fox where he's the A-side rather than the B-side of a main event. And we finally saw Omar Figueroa lose. Just talk about time on that one. Let's see if Omar Figueroa Jr. can dedicate himself and fight at a smaller weight class, and maybe his style might actually put him in some good spots there. But, you know, we don't need to see him in top-level welterweight stuff. Lipinets looks great. Hopefully we see him again soon. You know, look, if you really – it might even be a good stylistic matchup to have him fight Ugas, and the winner of that can get a title shot, you know, if neither of those guys gets an obvious title shot next. Luis Neri's, the hype train slowed down there a bit, but I think everyone still definitely wants to see him against Inoue, which obviously we need to see where Inoue signs to see how likely that would be. Mike Lee to hardcore fans has always been a joke, and I hope he uses that degree from Notre Dame for something other than boxing after that loss to Plant. Plant, on the other hand, look, stays in line for, you know, a big fight at 168 in the PBC universe. Not sure I need to see him again ever with someone on Mike Lee's level, but there are plenty of other good fights out there for him. And I think it's also easy to forget that this was his first title defense. I mean, he's gotten a lot of press and he's gotten so much attention in 2019 that you might think he's been around for 3 or 4 years at a really high level. This is his first title defense, so let's see him again with better competition. But I'm not sitting here being like, oh, he can never fight some, you know, lesser fights again. Like, no, I mean, look, see better than Mike Lee, but all right, you guys get the point. Ajagbe, I mean, with Ajagbe, we finally see him in with a real boxer, and we get some interesting results. I mean, he didn't He controlled the fight with his jab, and he didn't look great, but I think it's one of those results that tell you, you know, most people say, oh, the hype train slows down. I actually think his ceiling is might even be higher than just the KO artist we thought we were seeing, even though this wasn't necessarily great TV, but just because of how he controlled the fight with his jab. So his overall ceiling, you know, I was pretty impressed with that. Moving on to the following weekend, let's start with the Showtime card. On Saturday, July 27th from Baltimore on Showtime, we have Gervonta Davis beating Ricardo Nunez by KO2 to retain his WBA junior welterweight title, which is not really the WBA title, but nonetheless. Yorkis Gamboa beats Rocky Martinez by KO2 at lightweight, and Ladarius Miller beats Jezreel Corrales at lightweight. The main event averages 553,000 viewers. It was the 38th rated program of the day on cable TV. I think it peaked at over 590, maybe near 600. The other fights on the card averaged 460 and 452,000 viewers. They were the 55th and 56th rated cable shows of the day. Remember, Showtime splits their fights up into individual shows. It got serious competition from the UFC on ESPN. The prelims to the UFC pay-per-view were the fourth best cable show of the day. So Showtime coming in, not the most impressive show on paper to me. There are some pretty solid bright spots, I'd say. Like, first is Showtime hasn't typically done well in younger demographics. This show actually does okay. It got a 0.19 in men 18 to 49. And actually in adults 18 to 34 and men 18 to 34, it does really strong. It cracks the top 15 in men 18 to 34, which for pay cable is really, really good. You know, and there's further evidence that it was a strong event. I mean, in terms of like Google search numbers and some social metrics, it did really well compared, you know, even better in some cases to the UFC pay-per-view and a lot of other things that evening. Like, it got a hit on SportsCenter. Though, I mean, I do want to point out those are more circumstantial things, but I think noteworthy, and it speaks to the audience that, you know, Showtime and PBC in particular, and PBC's failed to do it really on Fox, has failed to sort of corral, you know, such an important audience. And it's more important that that audience is on Fox where they sell ads. But still, I think it's pretty significant for Showtime as well. I mean, bottom line is Tank Davis is clearly meaningful in terms of any television business moving forward. You know, and I also want to give Showtime and all the parties here some real credit for how this actually played out on TV, not just the ratings. Like, first of all, Showtime as a broadcaster had a lot of fun with the idea that this main event was a homecoming fight for Tank. I mean, they made no bones about the fact that they were putting on a showcase fight for him. And I think that's really respectful to their audience. You know, the show had a great atmosphere, and that was clear from the broadcast. And look, side note for the PBC, PBC's taken a lot of criticism for years for not going to hometowns of the fighters, not being, you know, the big ticket selling machine or whatever. That is not the case here. They should be lauded for the fact that they went into Baltimore, and Baltimore clearly loves Tank Davis. I mean, Showtime had some really good pieces on the broadcast about how long it's been and since it was a title fight in Baltimore and some of the history, you know. And I'll be honest, like, it was kind of surprising to me because Baltimore is really close to DC, and that, you know, sort of that entire area in general produces a lot of good fighters. And so you just be thinking, you know, and look, PBC put on fights in Northern Virginia and the DMV area in general. It's starting to become a much bigger market. And, you know, I was surprised that it had been so long since there was a major fight like that in Baltimore. If I have a critique for what Showtime is doing with Davis, you know, on a larger scale in 2019, like, Tank Davis is clearly a centerpiece of programming at Showtime. He's already been featured on two main events, and I know the first one was supposed to be against Abner Morris. Abner Morris is a name opponent, but also coming up in weight. I get that Davis deserves a homecoming fight in Baltimore, but if this is it for Davis's year, I'm not psyched about it. You know, if he does end up fighting Tevin Farmer, who, to his credit, he called out in the ring after the fight, that's great. I'm all about seeing Davis Farmer on Showtime and Andre Charlo on DAZN. If we're talking about trade, we'll get to all that in a second. You know, if we're seeing him versus Gamboa or another mismatch or not even again on Showtime this year, then no, like that's not good enough. Like maybe if he fights someone really strong and then comes back and fights Gamboa, you know, in his fight after that in Baltimore early next year or something like that, then we're going to look, you know, I think, by the way, they should be going to Baltimore at least once a year. Like we look back on it. Okay. I'm fine with Gamboa in that instance, but in terms of the really other big fights out there for Tank Davis, Lomachenko is clearly the eventual pay-per-view fight that would mean a lot. But I think there's some, you know, there's a lot of fights that make a lot of sense. I mean, even if Farmer fights Jojo Diaz on DAZN, they're talking about that. Like, but between Cancio, Burchelt, the Herring Lamont Roach winner, Ito, Mickey Roman, maybe even a rehabbed Alberto Machado, you have a ton of fun or high-level fighters that would make great matchups. And I know as I say this, none of them are quote-unquote on the right side of the street, but I'm starting to be less and less of a believer in that concept, especially based on what happened in Dallas, and we'll get to that in a second. You know, Miguel Burchell maybe has been paid a couple times, like, so that's one thing, and he's probably a division kingpin. But everyone else I listed would probably just jump at a seven-figure payday to go fight Davis on Showtime. It's if Golden Boy tries to block the Farmer Davis fight by making Jojo Diaz versus Tevin Farmer, then PBC should do what all the other promoters have tried to do to them. And they should make Andrew Cancio a big offer to, quote-unquote, unify the WBA belt on Showtime. Cancio only got paid $75,000 to beat Machado and then $150,000 to defend it. And the dude is still working his day job. Like, do whatever you got to do. Make a phone call to the WBA to get them to mandate the fight. Offer him $1.5 million or something like that. Like $1.2 million, $1.5 million to fight Tank Davis on Showtime. And see what Golden Boy does. I mean, Cancio is the perfect candidate to make a move like this because he hasn't made big money yet. And that would be an incredible fight. And I mean, after a rating like this, PBC clearly has a future star on their hands. And now they're in the exact same position that Top Rank is with Crawford, except they're in sort of a less glamour division. So it's going to take less money to get another fighter to come over and have them fight Davis on a PBC platform. And I don't understand what the hesitancy is to start that process now. I mean, you know you're going to work together with ESPN on Wilder Fury 2. Like, this is, again, lower weight class, lower money for the fights. Let's say Herring beats Roach this fall. You're telling me that Top Rank would tell a fighter like Herring that he couldn't take a seven-figure payday to go over and unify on Showtime? Of course not. Like, they'd make that fight for early 2020, or at least I think they would, even Burchelt. Like I said, he's been paid a couple times, but, like, you know, and I understand, like, Top Rank does have to keep some fighters out there for Lomachenko, and this division is right below Lomachenko, but, you know, my overall point is there's workable solutions across multiple promoters, multiple platforms, you know, to open up possibilities for Davis, you know, especially if Showtime is going to be behind him in a major way. And you don't need to do this for every single fight of his. We just need to see some of these. Moving to the undercard. You know, we saw Gamboa beat Martinez and look really good. I've been over, I don't think Davis should get Gamboa next. I mean, like, name fighter, it's a big mismatch. You know, and just every fight that Davis does, it doesn't need to be a big fight, but we haven't seen him since Pedraza. We haven't really seen him in with anybody remotely good. And I don't want this whole thing to be a pointless exercise. I don't mind when you take a little bit of time in developing him, like I said at the top, but this thing cannot just be him wiping out a bunch of people, you know, within the PBC universe. There's literally, like, no top 10 fighters in his weight class, you know, in the PBC. They just need to start going across the street and doing what I'm talking about here. The Ladarius Miller beating Corrales. I mean, other than the fact that kind of the referee bungled that point deduction, which probably gave Miller the win instead of a draw, neither fighter looked great. It wasn't great TV. All right, moving on to Saturday, July 27th. On DAZN, we had a contender for Fight of the Year in my book. Jose Ramirez beats Mo Hooker by KO6 in a junior welterweight unification with the WBO and WBC titles at stake. Also on the card, Tevin Farmer beats Guillaume Francois in a mandatory for Farmer's IBF junior lightweight title. Murat Gassiev was supposed to make his heavyweight debut, but was off the card due to injury. Lots of ramifications here for the main event. Let's cover the undercard first before we focus on the main event. And I'm basically saying the same things as I said about Tank Davis. Like, we don't need to see Tevin Farmer fight any more of these guys he's fighting on DAZN. His activity's been wonderful, especially for his, you know, for a guy who's had his career, you know, he's at the point, he does not make great TV unless he's matched up with a really high-level opponent. I think we have enough evidence right now where we've seen that. And I just finished talking about this whole division from a Tank Davis perspective. If DAZN didn't want to, quote-unquote, go across the street, they could easily make Andrew Cancio versus Tevin Farmer or JoJo Diaz versus Tevin Farmer. Sounds like they're talking about JoJo Diaz. Like, let's see something here. You know, they can probably, like, Tank Davis called out Farmer, probably make that deal with Showtime. Like, there's so much talent at ESPN and DAZN. You can do another trade with ESPN. Like, you can do in-house fights to unify. There's so many ways this could go. Enough building in this weight class. Let's see these guys fight each other. There's a top 10 where they all should be fighting each other. No one is fiscally big enough where they should be turning down million-dollar paydays here, you know, to make these fights. And this is a division where, look, if Floyd Mayweather really wants Tank Davis to be a pay-per-view fighter, this is a great step in the right direction. But doing a Showtime rating where less than 600,000 people watch your fighter is not the right pathway to becoming a pay-per-view fighter, and especially if you're fighting nobodies, like, that's not going to make a difference. Like, you got to start stepping up the opponent level. And the same, by the way, same goes for every other side of the street here. Like, I'm not sure any of these other guys are ending up going to be pay-per-view fighters, but I think there's some really great fights to be made. On to the really fun stuff, the main event. Jose Ramirez beats Mo Hooker by KO6 in a fight that was so significant for so many reasons. Let's go over the in-ring stuff first, and then let's get to the fun business stuff. In the ring, this was an incredible fight, and I think had it gone maybe 3 or 4 rounds longer with 1 or 2 momentum swings, it would have been fight of the year. I mean, as it stands, I'd still put it in the same, you know, sort of the conversation for it. Like, most pundits have Pac Thurman and J-Rock Hurd and AJ Ruiz, like, you know, sort of that group of, you know, a couple other fights. There's a couple other less meaningful, more action fights, you know, but there's been some really good fights. It probably stays in that category. Nothing has really broken through yet. I love the fact that both fighters came out with certain game plans, then they had to make adjustments in the ring, and then they had to adjust to the other fighter's adjustments. It was a legit stoppage for me. It exposed some of the weaknesses that we'd seen with Hooker before that he'd never truly been made to pay for. But, you know, Hooker also just as easily could have won by KO not even a round or two earlier, where he had really sort of established a great distance for the length he has. On the business side, this fight has, you know, so many significant things for so many reasons. The talking point among most of the boxing media is that this is everything that's right in the sport. Which, and I think most of that is true, but I think we should bring up some concerns. Let's start with the good stuff first. Like, obviously, incredible that this ended up working out as part of a network trade where fighters went across both promotional entities and platforms to make big fights. Like, that in and of itself is significant. The fact that it happened in a unification fight and that you saw rival promoters talking about the fight and promoting it together was significant. Also, ESPN really covered the fight as a news entity, and to give them credit, like, you know, they actually did this with Tank Davis too. Like, SportsCenter put out some social media stuff on his win. I mean, we're at the point now, I don't want to congratulate people too much for doing what they were supposed to be doing, like, just doing their job correctly. But I think it is important that when a network trade like this happens, all parties follow through. ESPN could, you know, they could have just buried this fight because, you know, while ESPN as a news entity covers boxing, Disney, which owns all of ESPN content in some, you know, version, like, they're in a corporate war with DAZN. And so I think just simple things like this help encourage this behavior in the future. One of the things about this, I'd say, is a mixed bag. You know, or a cause for concern is the amount of money involved. Like, it's been lauded that Ramirez got $4 million, or probably more accurately, the Ramirez team, including Top Rank, got that $4 million payday to send the fight over to DAZN. That number is great, but remember, in the world of competing business models, if that is the bar to do a network trade, then they won't happen so often. And I hope they don't look at this as like a minimum payday for these types of things to happen in the future. Like, remember, this is all competing business models. Like, in terms of DAZN or ESPN Plus, that kind of a payday for an opponent, like, it might actually make some sense because it's cheap enough that it can be a big fight for a streaming service that isn't a huge quote-unquote pay-per-view fight, but one that qualifies as a smallish pay-per-view that reduces churn, you know, quote-unquote pay-per-view. Remember, like, these, they're streaming services, they're not pay-per-views. It reduces churn, it, you know, maybe it builds subs amongst hardcore fans, you know, to a certain extent. But, you know, both Ramirez and Mo Hooker, like, while they are champs, and this was unification fight and everything, there's probably no universe where this fight card would have been affordable on Fox or regular ESPN or Showtime. And I don't think it would have worked on pay-per-view. Like, it would have probably been less than 150,000 pay-per-view buys, even if it was reasonably priced. Look, I don't know exactly what these guys got paid, but supposedly Hooker got his first seven-figure payday. You know, I think he made close to that fighting on ESPN last year. So, I don't think he just got paid $1 million. Like, I think he got paid more. Like, there's, with Farmer fighting on the card, I know he makes a couple hundred grand. Like, this thing had to be at least $6 million in terms of total cost, probably more. So when you look at it from that way, could Showtime or ESPN have afforded it on regular Showtime or ESPN? Now, they probably would have had to redo their pay scales to afford this type of card. I mean, we could see that happen. I would love to see that happen, but we aren't there yet. The major takeaway here is we want this type of behavior to happen more often. And it definitely made sense in this scenario. Yes, it was a risk, but it still could end up working out for all parties. Like, Top Rank gets Ramirez to come back over to ESPN as a unified champ. They can use him and Crawford now to lure Regis Prograis over to ESPN, win or lose in the World Boxing Super Series finals. Like, Josh Taylor is with Matchroom now, and you have a legit former champ as an eventual opponent for him, win or lose in the World Boxing Super Series finals, you know, with Hooker, that, like, you can match those two guys up. Like, given how close and how many different momentum swings there were in the fight, like, you could see a rematch happening at the right moment. And given the fact that the platforms and promoters have now worked together, like, if Josh Taylor wins, you could see a pathway to a full unification in the weight class at some point with, you know, Taylor and Ramirez. You know, amazing side note on this weight class, it has the potential to be completely unified twice in a matter of, like, just a couple of years, which just goes to show you how important things like the World Boxing Super Series are, and unification fights are in general, because stars emerge from unification fights, and that's the stone cold reality here. So, look, for Top Rank, in addition to that, it's like, in addition to having another carrot to get Prograis, like, if they need Terrence Crawford, if they need an opponent for him after he takes care of his mandatory, now you have this unified champ at 140 who's Hispanic and has a really easy story to tell, potential opponent for Crawford. Like, that can be a pay-per-view fight. Like, if the PBC just continues to freeze out opponents for Crawford, and, you know, might give Crawford some leverage there. Like, I personally wouldn't do that. Next, for, you know, if I'm taking care of Ramirez, I would go for that total unification at 140. I think he'd get paid well for it. I think he has real potential star power at the pay-per-view box office on his own if he does that. But there, you know, a lot of good things to come out of this. And I think what people, you know, hopefully what people take away is that DAZN and ESPN Plus, like, when you're really talking about network trades, DAZN and ESPN Plus, because of their different business models that I described above, they actually have a lot more flexibility to make these trades happen. And I think PBC, by the way, can make straight-up trades on Showtime and Fox 2. But in most of these instances, I think it's easiest to make the trade between two streaming platforms. When you do Showtime linear, versus DAZN or ESPN Plus streaming. I think it's still possible, but I think bottom line, this is a great starting point. And I actually don't think it inhibits trades at 130 pounds, where those fights would not break the Showtime or Fox pay scale. Another noteworthy thing bringing up, though. Okay, one final thing before we're done here. I want to briefly touch on the Canelo issues. And again, this is something I talked about with Mannix. As it stands, Canelo and Goldboy basically make DAZN look like total fools at the poker table. I mean, it's optically terrible for DAZN. I mean, in their defense, though, I'm not actually sure it will end up hurting them a ton this year. And I say that it hurts them in terms of the opportunity, but we'll get to that in a second. I mean, the bigger issue has always been that they are facing a time issue. We're getting their sub base up to the point where they can have these bigger discussions. And this is part of the practicality part. It sounds like the NFL Sunday Ticket package is going to go back to DirecTV for this year in particular. And maybe, I think, I'm not sure exactly when that ends up. It might be 2021 or 2022, something like that. But the out in that package was for this year. So if that's not in play, it probably buys them another year or two specifically for that package to get their sub base up so they can try to make, you now try to make Canelo Triple G 3 in 2020, that kind of thing. But in terms of, and that's what I mean when I say in terms of true practicality, like that was clearly one of the things they were up against in terms of actually being able to go to the NFL and say, hey, look, we've got a great sub base now for where we are, and we're going to make Canelo Triple G and Ruiz AJ2 in the fall. Those things will all really build up our sub bases. Like, this is great. That's actually something that would probably make a lot of sense. But look, that's not happening now. So they have a little bit more time if they're specifically targeting that package, which, I think that, it's one of the things that I'm sure they're targeting. So in terms of like all the potential of what this fall could have been for DAZN, this is still a disaster. I mean, it could have been Canelo Triple G 3 in September and then that AJ Ruiz rematch. And I think it's really important whether that's in New York in US primetime or in the UK. Now DAZN might just end up being Canelo Derevchenko in October, possibly AJ Ruiz too in the UK, not in primetime here. Like, that opportunity cost is outrageous in terms of making those real subscription driving fights for DAZN. But I do think, like, in terms of just maintaining what they have and possibly building a little bit, this isn't, they could probably work around the margins. They could probably make another good fight or two. Like, they will probably have a great chance just by Canelo fighting of maintaining a lot of their subs. I mean, there's or getting a good argument at getting a lot of the lapsed subs back. I'm going to do a deeper dive into this, like I said, I think once I get all the facts straight, because not only is there the drama playing out right now, but I think we just really need to see what the schedule looks like for the rest of the fall. I mean, it sounds like with what they're doing with the World Boxing Super Series, they're not putting it all in one event. They're sort of separating those fights out. I think there's a lot of other things to look at. I mean, on their podcast, Mike Coppinger and Lance Pugmire talked about how, like, there might be trouble brewing with Canelo and Golden Boy, where Canelo is pissed at Golden Boy for getting too much money from DAZN for the other stuff. I mean, you've got the whole DAZN thing where they're sitting there with Golden Boy being like, you guys, like, publicly made us look like idiots. Or not idiots. Idiots is the wrong word. But you've really publicly exposed DAZN in a way. Not just at the poker table, but like these negotiations became very public. Like, and DAZN has literally saved your company and given you so much money. Like what is going on there? I mean, that's just, oh man. I mean, that is, if you're DAZN, you are probably thinking like, what are we doing with these guys? Like, what are these Yahoos doing here? But this isn't the universe where HBO and a lot of people equate DAZN to HBO. It's just not the case. I mean, HBO did not make enough money on the HBO pay-per-views. They made a couple million bucks, basically. They made a small license fee, and they never pushed the cable companies. They always maintained that the relationship they had with the cable companies was more important than pushing the license fee percentage, which is clearly, you know, not what Fox is doing right now. Anyways, that's a whole different discussion. I still think at the end of the day, if you're a hardcore fan, DAZN has delivered great boxing for a great price. Like, especially if they end up making all the World Boxing Super Series fights you're talking about in the fall. But look, let's see what their fall schedule looks like, and then let's talk about that. All right, preview section, relatively quick here. On Friday, August 2nd, there is a DAZN card from the UK that is not all that impressive. On Saturday, August 3rd, ESPN Plus has a show featuring Michael Conlan. Conlan's a 50-1 favorite, and I think, like, I'm only mentioning it because Conlan at one time was supposed to be a pretty big factor for Top Rank and expected to be in some pretty big fights. Like, here, now we're at late replacement territory in terms of the opponent. That's why he's such a big favorite. Conlan, he might end up being a commercial draw in New York and in Ireland, but for me, it's like, let's see better than this. I know that there's a lot of circumstances here, but even the original opponent was the opponent that supposedly, you know, that beat him in the Olympics, and they were going to make a big deal out of that. Let's see Michael Conlan step it up or figure out a real career pathway. He's a little bit older too, so I'll leave it at that. Later that day, the best fight card of that day is PBC on Fox. The main event is Adam Kalnowski versus Chris Areola. Also on the card, Marcus Brown versus John Pascal and Curtis Stevens versus Wale Omotoso. Kalnowski is like a 20-ish-to-1 favorite, maybe a little bit higher. Brown's about 20-to-1. Curtis Stevens is like a 4-to-1 favorite. I think all these could at least be really good TV. And I think, look, Kalnowski is great TV on his own, basically against anybody. And I actually think Chris Areola, it'll probably be one-sided, but Chris Areola puts up a pretty good fight. And, you know, any heavyweight fight with now has some kind of meaning the way the division's going. I think this will probably do pretty well in the TV ratings. And we're definitely into the dregs of August. The next week, there's two cards, one on ESPN Plus, one on DAZN, which I guess compared to what we've been getting is is way less, and just the overall name value and qualities are lesser of stature. We have Carl Frampton on ESPN Plus in Philadelphia fighting Emmanuel Dominguez at featherweight. Jesse Magdaleno versus Rafael Rivera also on the card. And the same day on DAZN from Grand Prairie, Texas, we have Virgil Ortiz, who is might be the one of the best prospects in the sport right now. He's fighting Antonio Orozco. I think it's a big time step up fight for Ortiz. There's no odds out on any of these cards though, and I'm looking forward to seeing Ortiz versus Orozco. But you know, we've seen Orozco make some really good TV, but you know, I would expect Virgil Ortiz to beat him. All right. Good episode. You'll definitely get the Top Rank episode next time, because I don't know what my life is going to be like now with a newborn baby, and I've already done the research for that. we'll see if I totally am able to, if Dave and Gabe and I are totally able to edit it out. My daughter actually burst into this, into this episode. So hopefully, that wasn't much of a time disruption there, because I had to redo a couple things on the sound wise. But hopefully, you know, we're back and there's a little lull in August. It sounds like there'll be a little bit of a lull at the beginning of September, and then we'll get back into the big fights coming later this fall. Good stuff. Talk to you guys in 2 weeks. Did you get what you was looking for?